Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, a new convention on the rights of domestic workers aims to stamp out exploitation and abuse. Catholics and Orthodox leaders come together for a crucial working group meeting in Crete, and a summit on business and ethics takes place here in the Vatican. Ethical investments, social responsibility, honesty and transparency. Are these constraints on the cutthroat business community, or are they, on the contrary, resources that can help business grow and survive when the going gets tough? Well, that crucial question was at the heart of a summit meeting here in the Vatican, bringing in CEOs and chairmen and women of global corporations and financial institutions to share best practices that take ethics seriously. The meeting on Thursday and Friday was held at the Pontifical Academy of Sciences in the Vatican Gardens, co-sponsored by the Vatican's Justice and Peace Council and the Fidelis International Institute.
The challenge is to show how it is possible to organize an economic activity incorporating, as I said, the ethical dimension and showing that that creates more wealth for everybody and ultimately what is called the common good.
Italian professor Stefano Zamagni teaches economics at Bologna University and serves as a consultant to the Pontifical Justice and Peace Council.
We have to convince, not by words but with facts, that business firms, if they incorporate in their everyday activity the ethical dimension, that does not imply a reduction of profits. On the opposite, an augmentation, profitability, productivity, etc., etc.
As you say, the challenge is to move from words to facts. Many of the business leaders here would agree that this is all very good in theory, but not so easy to put into practice in their very busy working lives.
No, that is not true. That is not true, because I know many businessmen, many entrepreneurs in different types of sector of activity, who, on the other hand, have been able in recent times to put together the two, and they are flourishing. Look what happened in this crisis. Look, who are the companies, the banks who went bankrupt? Tell me. All those who separated the ethics from the economic life. On the other hand, why those companies? I could even mention the names, but that is not proper, because certainly I would forget many other relevant names. They were able to overcome the strictures of the present crisis because of the compatibility they have been able to realize.
Pope Benedict has already expressed his concerns that 2 years on from that economic crisis, many of the banks are heading the same way as they were beforehand, that they haven't really learned any lessons from this. Do you share that concern?
In a sense, yes. Or better to say, they have learned the lesson. The point is like a child when he goes to school. He can listen to the school teacher and learn the lesson, but unless when he goes back home, does his or her own homework, the lesson will remain just words. Here is the same. The lesson has been understood very well. The point is that, for one reason or another, they are unable to translate it into practice. And that, let me say, it's mainly not because of bad faith, but because of cultural. The point is that in our world, the most important business schools all over the world are obsolete. They keep on teaching. It's enough to read the textbooks or the material. I wouldn't say wrong, but obsolete things. And so most managers have been brought up within that culture, and they believe that it's not possible, but that is not true. And that is why we need to accelerate the process of cultural transformation.
While there were many familiar faces like Professor Zamagni at this Ethics and Business Summit, there were also plenty of participants with no Catholic connections visiting the Vatican for the first time. Among them was Professor Andy Zelecki, former co-director of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government.
I think that at the end of the day, The economy has to work, has to produce value for the society. I mean, I think what's most important for me, if anybody asked me, are you for this particular mandate or this other regulation or this other requirement of business, my answer is always ultimately, does making that change tend to produce a stronger, more competitive economy with more jobs and a better standard of living for people? So my interest in it, you know, if someone could demonstrate compellingly that a stronger economy that's better for people in their lives actually derives from not putting so many expectations on business, I could be persuaded by that. I'm skeptical that that's the case, though. I tend to think that we'll have a stronger economy and have the kind of society that we want if most businesses, most of the time, are in a sense required to articulate what the theory is by which they produce value for that society. And different businesses will answer that different ways. Some will say, look, what we do is we're very good at the business that we run, and a byproduct of that is we produce a tremendous number of good jobs for the society. And that's the extent of our social contribution. That's very valuable. A different business might say, and I'll just pick out of the air, hedge funds. We can't make that same claim. What we mostly do is we help wealthy people become even wealthier in a way that's not bad for the society, but it's not particularly salutary, let's say. But many of us are philanthropists, and we take that wealth and we do these amazing things for the community that we live in because we have an ethos of giving back. That's another way to do it. So I don't think that there needs to be any particular one way that businesses deliver this beneficial impact for the society. But there should be a way. I think that each business, of course, in the early years of a new enterprise, you're just trying to make it. But once you get past that hurdle, I think that every business should have an articulable approach to delivering value for the society that they can stand by, that they're proud to enunciate. And that can come in many different ways. So, long-winded answer, but my real answer to your question is that I'm concerned at the end of the day with what makes for a strong economy and a strong society, and I think that this is one of the ways.
There are many people looking at the recent economic downturn, the global economic crisis, who say theory is okay, but in practice businesses just ignore that until they're absolutely forced to take some account of what people want and what is good for society. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think you can certainly find examples of that in particular cases. I think that really what you need to do is you need to focus people on... It's very easy to get caught up in the day-to-day. But I think if you, for example, at a gathering like this, I mean, these are very successful people. They're very busy people. They've decided to take time out of their... It's easy for us academics, but for the business people, it's hard to take time out of their busy lives to do this. The fact that they're here means that these particular people care about this and actually are being mindful of this issue. So I think that certainly in some cases you have business leaders who just don't give a damn about this. But I think in the more typical case, it's just through lack of mindfulness about it, lack of attention, because you get caught up in what you're doing. I think that most people do want to find meaning in what they're devoting the bulk of their waking hours to. They want meaning, and most people would prefer to be part of an enterprise that is not simply about making money, but actually is contributing toward a stronger and better society.
My thanks there to Andy Zelicky from Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. And earlier you heard Stefano Zamagni from Bologna University. The ancient Greek island town of Rethymno on the west coast of Crete is hosting a crucial ecumenical encounter between Catholic and Orthodox leaders this week. The president of the Pontifical Council for Christian Unity, Cardinal Kurt Koch, and Metropolitan Hilarion Alfayev, in charge of external relations for the Russian Orthodox Patriarchate, are amongst those participating in the working group meeting taking place from June 14th to 18th. The main task of the group is to draw up a new joint document on the theme, the role of the Bishop of Rome in the communion of the Church during the first millennium, to replace an earlier draft document that was rejected by some of the Orthodox churches. But why is this such an important encounter? And what kind of progress can we expect by the week's end? To find out more, I spoke to the Secretary of the Pontifical Council for Christian Unity, Bishop Brian Farrell.
There has been a formal theological dialogue between the Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church since 1980. And down the years, many issues have been examined and many agreements have been reached. Everybody understands that between East and West, there is much theological agreement, but that we carry the burden of a difficult history and also cultural, psychological distance between the churches. Finally, the progress of this dialogue has led to the point where we are now studying the principal, most important point of difference, which is the perception of the role of the Bishop of Rome in the communion of the Church. It was decided that the study would be concentrated first on the first millennium when the churches were united, undivided. And then we would pass on to the second millennium in order to find a model for the third millennium in which we are beginning.
This phase of the debate was started in 2008, at a plenary?
This phase began in 2008 after we had completed a very important document, which we called the Ravenna document, on the question of authority and structure of the church at every level, local, intermediate, and universal. After that agreement, the logical step was to begin the study on the role of the Bishop of Rome as the first among the bishops. We have worked for the last few years to examine the history of the way in which the bishops of Rome in the first millennium exercised their ministry, relations between East and West in the first millennium. The document that we were examining has appeared to the Orthodox to be too historical and not enough theological. So we have this sub-commission now working to rewrite this document in a more theological way, and hopefully by drawing out the theological principles that were at work in the historical events, we will reach a point where we have a common understanding. This is a very important point then in the development of the dialogue.
Part of the problem stems from differing viewpoints within the Orthodox world itself, doesn't it? Between particularly the Ecumenical Patriarch and the Russian Patriarchate.
Well, when we talk of the primacy of the Bishop of Rome, I think some Orthodox may have the fear that the concept or the implications of such a primacy might be applied also in the East, something which Orthodoxy has never actually had. And I think at the moment, therefore, there may be a certain hesitancy to apply anything to Constantinople that perhaps the Orthodox in general would be willing to apply to Rome.
Metropolitan Hilarion is there in Greece attending this meeting. Yes. How significant is that, do you think?
Well, it's important. I mean, it's important that all the Orthodox churches participate. Practically all of them do, personally, by having their representative there. We had a moment in the discussion leading up to the Ravenna document in which the Russian delegation withdrew from the discussion because of internal tensions with Constantinople over a particular question of jurisdiction in one of the local churches. That problem has been solved, at least theoretically, through a meeting of representatives of all the Orthodox churches, and they agreed that from now on, only the autonomous Orthodox churches and autocephalous Orthodox churches would take part in the dialogue.
There's been talk, hasn't there, in this sense of a pan-Orthodox conference or pan-Orthodox
Yes.
council to take place. How likely is that to happen in the near future?
Well, it has been talked about for decades. In recent times, happily, there has been a much more consistent effort to prepare such a meeting. However, there are a number of items on the agenda which still have to be agreed upon among the Orthodox themselves. And at the present time, these are difficulties of such an important nature that it's not easy to see how they can go forward with holding such a pan-Orthodox meeting of all the churches.
Which continues to be a significant obstacle for you in your dialogue, doesn't it?
Of course, if the Orthodox were to have this pan-Orthodox meeting, they could reach an agreement among themselves on many issues, including the issue of their relationship to the rest of the Christian world, and in particular to the Catholic Church. And this would supposedly and hopefully help the dialogue. The fact that the issues which make the meeting difficult do not basically involve their relationship to us, but their relationship among themselves, is perhaps a sign that someday they will be able to reach that agreement.
Coming back briefly to this Greece meeting, what do you hope will come out of that? There should be then a finished document looking more specifically at the theological issues. Is that correct?
Well, the subcommission is meeting for the first time. Whether they will be able in a few days to produce such an important, difficult document is still to be seen. It would not be tragic in my mind that they might have to meet again. The point is that eventually we will have a sufficiently grounded and worthwhile document to present to the full plenary of the dialogue. It's not so important that it be done quickly, but that it be done well.
So you'd be looking ahead to the next plenary, wouldn't you?
Yes, we don't have a date for the next plenary because all will depend on the development of this working document. My hope is not so much tied to the calendar as it is to the substance of the study itself. It is most important that we move forward on a firm, solid basis. Because it's important to remember that the methodology here is not to say Catholics say this and the Orthodox say that. The methodology is to say only what Catholics and Orthodox can say together. This naturally means that the debate, the discussion, is exhaustive. It has to reach a conclusion about every sentence, even every word sometimes. That makes it difficult, but it also means that when we have a document, we have an agreement.
My thanks there to Bishop Brian Farrell, Secretary of the Pontifical Council for the Promotion of Christian Unity. Maids, nannies, cooks, home helps. Domestic workers have been called by many different names in the past, but now finally their labour and above all their key contribution to national economies has been officially recognised through a new convention adopted by the United Nations on Thursday. The International Convention for Domestic Workers' Rights was voted on by delegates at the ILO's International Labour Conference following 2 weeks of intense negotiations between governments, employers and workers. Once ratified and implemented by member countries, its goal is to put an end to the exploitation and abuse that men, women and children have suffered, some of them treated as little more than slaves or sex objects by unscrupulous employers.
There are abuses and there are problems, especially when we have young girls being engaged in domestic work.
The Holy See's permanent observer to the UN in Geneva, Archbishop Silvano Tomasi, told me that Thursday's vote marks a crucial step forward on a journey that has been ongoing for many decades.
This convention that was voted on and passed with a very overwhelming vote marks an important point of arrival of a long process. Already back in 1965, there was discussion of providing some form of protection for domestic workers because they were considered, and they still are considered, a group, a category of workers, mostly invisible because they work in families within the domestic walls of a house. and they are subjected to a variety of abuses and therefore in need of particular protection. Over the decades, this awareness has been growing, and finally, we have arrived today at passing an instrument that will become a major leverage point or a tool in the hands of organizers, people, the workers themselves, for the protection of their human rights. In the world, there are some between 50 to 100 million people, mostly women, who are involved in this type of work. And it was about time that such a large number of individuals could receive support from the international community. Many times they are immigrant women doing work to take care of children, of elderly people, of sick people, so that other women and other men can be free to go to work or to pursue a career. We have a kind of a new phenomenon appearing today, transnational families. We have families in the developed countries. They function because there are members of families of poor countries providing some of the care and doing some of the work that is necessary to keep a family going. And so this is an interesting point that needs probably further reflection in order to protect families both from the point of view of countries that are sending out workers and the point of view of families that are receiving them.
How closely have you or other members of the Holy See delegation been involved in these negotiations? There have been a very intense period of debate over this, hasn't there?
The permanent mission of the Holy See here in Geneva, where there is the third pillar on one side of the UN organization, that is the Human Rights Council, and where there is the base of the International Labour Organization, has been following closely this issue because it affects hundreds of thousands of Catholic women, among other things. I remember seeing them in taking an hour off on Sunday afternoon in Hong Kong, where you have hundreds of women on the street chatting, smiling, enjoying the company of fellow Filipinas. And then for the rest of the week, they are buried, so to say, in their domestic work for which they are trying to earn some money to support their own families back in the Philippines. A lot of Catholic organizations, Catholic-inspired organizations like the International Colpin Society, the International Catholic Migration Commission, the National Domestic Workers Movement in India, that has some 3 million members, but it is obviously most of them are not Catholics, but they are led by a Catholic nun, Sister Marie Michael, and so forth. So it is a topic that has been very close to the heart of Catholic organizations, sensitive to the needs of migrant women, domestic workers, women that are trafficked, really expressing in this way a major concern of our tradition of love for the people who have no voice. And in this way, these Catholic forces have been pushing and contributing a lot to the achievement of this new international legal instrument.
In a sense, though, the hard work really starts now, doesn't it? Because although you have this new instrument, the problem now is to convince governments to ratify and to implement. How difficult do you see this next step as being?
The challenge is coordinating the forces active in the field to motivate national societies to ratify this new convention. The political will to translate into action and national laws the provisions of this convention and the recommendation that is attached to it is very critical. I think, the Catholic-inspired NGOs have a new chapter of work in their hands. They need to coordinate and motivate society at large and to create enough of a momentum so that individual states may very quickly ratify this instrument. And in a way, this becomes a new chapter that is added to the social doctrine of the church. The concern for this segment of work, this different and very humane type of service and work that is performed within the families, so that touches directly persons, children, elderly, that allows families to function and develop according to their own plans. It's an important, it's an delicate type of work, and therefore the ratification of this instrument becomes more urgent, so that the end result become positive both for the families that hire these persons to carry out domestic work, and it will be beneficial, the result also for the individual workers, and protect a form of protection that otherwise they wouldn't have.
Some time ago, we saw domestic workers, particularly immigrant workers without legal documents in the United States, going out on strike to underline just what an essential role they play in our national economies. And yet we've been able to ignore this for so long.
Yes, it has been a long way. But finally, there is a fairly good instrument, not perfect, but very positive, because it has provisions to prevent forms of abuse, to create conditions for decent work, to give freedom to organize in unions to these people, to have an adequate remunerations, so a salary that is legal and that is adequate. There is a form of protection in a specific way for minors that are used as domestic workers in some countries. There is a provision for giving a minimum of privacy and space for private growth to the domestic workers, so that they can keep their documents, that they can decide to go out of the house in their hours of free time, that they are not obliged. So that there are very good provisions for their health, the health and the security for domestic workers. But now the challenge is to translate this into practice, because especially for women who are in a country working without proper documentation, irregular migrants in particular, there remains a big problem to have their work respected, their work remunerated in a fair way, and so forth. So yes, there is a lot of work that needs to be done, and this enormously large number of workers has to surface, become part of the consciousness of unions, of public opinion, and so that their work is appreciated on one side, and on the other side that they are protected according to normal standards of protection for all workers.
My thanks there to Archbishop Silvana Tomasi, the Holy See's permanent observer to the United Nations in Geneva. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at the same time tomorrow, or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.